Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
What important Asian nation has roughly triple the population of the United States, its own nuclear weapons arsenal, and is on track to have the third largest economy and first largest middle class on the planet within 15 years? You might have guessed China, but the answer is India. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. U.S. leaders have watched China's development with wary fascination for decades. Understanding how important it is to get diplomatic relations right and knowing any conflict China engages in will have global repercussions. India, with which we have broadly warmer relations, we worry less about. But my guest says we have a lot to lose by not giving India at least as much attention as China. Anya Manuel is co-founder and partner at the strategic consulting firm Rice Hadley Gates and a former State Department official responsible for South Asia policy. Her new book is called The Brave New World, India, China, and the United States. Anya, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much, Chris. Happy to be here.
Why do we fear China?
China is rising very rapidly, and its system is quite different from that of the United States. And I think this actually causes some of the difference in how we view China and how we view India. China is an authoritarian system. It's increasingly aggressive in the South China Sea and the East China Sea, and its companies are expanding rapidly around the world. So understandably, we're a little bit more concerned about its rise than we are about that of India, which is a democracy, and we have broadly positive relations. What I say in the book that actually both these countries will have a dramatic impact on us here in the United States. Let me give you some examples. Both of these countries will be the fastest growing markets for our companies. Within a decade or so, they will have nearly 3 billion people between them and the world's largest middle classes, so we'll be selling to them. And we will need both of them, both China and India, to solve some of the world's biggest problems. For example, climate change. We used to think that we could, if the U.S. and Europe agreed, we could reach a good compromise on climate change, but that's no longer the case because China and India will be the first and third largest emitters. Those are just some examples.
Is India positioning itself to acquire energy and raw resources in the same ways that China is, meaning, you know, making deals in places like Africa and Latin America?
It is to some extent, but not nearly as much. Its reach on the world stage is still much smaller. So Chinese companies last year invested almost $200 billion abroad. The U.S. is still bigger. We invested $350 billion abroad. But India is lagging behind. It's about $15 billion that it invests overseas. So while its companies are expanding, Tata bought Land Rover, for example, the huge rush that you see by Chinese companies in the Chinese state into Africa and Latin America, India has not yet emulated.
Before long, India is expected to overtake China in terms of sheer population. How important is the size of the Indian population?
It's very important for two reasons. By 2030, people estimate that India will have almost 1.5 billion people. That's a lot of people. And that's 100 million more than in China. And it has a couple of implications. India is a young country. We've heard a lot about how China is graying and aging. When I see my friends in China, people who are of middle age usually have one or two children, but they're taking care of four parents and eight grandparents. In India, the demographic effect is the opposite. The population is largely young, and by 2030, 70% of Indians will be working. Now, traditionally, that's when countries really take off. That's when growth explodes, the economy picks up. It's called the demographic dividend. India is trying to do that, and that's why its Prime Minister Narendra Modi is running around the world talking about Make in India, getting manufacturing jobs into India. It will be hard for them to do that because you can't take advantage of that demographic dividend unless you educate all those people and unless you get them good jobs. So that's what they're currently struggling with.
How does our focus on India and conflicts that it might engage does the focus on the tension between India and Pakistan draw attention away from disagreements that might exist between India and China?
I think India itself was quite concerned about Pakistan for decades. You know, as you know, in India as a nation, as it exists today, only started existing in the late 1940s when they gained independence from the British. And the larger Indian subcontinent was actually split into India, what is now India and Pakistan. A lot of conflict across those borders. Four wars have been fought. A lot of the terrorist acts that happen in India, Indians firmly believe, come from Pakistan and are pushed by Pakistan. A decade ago, when I was serving in the U.S. government, you could hardly get India to worry about China. But now that is mostly what Indian officials want to talk to us about. They are much more worried about China to their north than they are about Pakistan to their west.
Is the main source of tension between India and China over Nepal?
It is. Nepal isn't really a source of tension. The Dalai Lama, of course, fled from Tibet in the 1950s, which is in China, into India. And India has let him live peacefully in India for decades and decades. So that's a thorn in the side of the relationship. India sees China a lot like we see it. And I sometimes say to my students at Stanford, we're frenemies. We have to get along because we have a lot of economic interests. Our companies depend on each other. But militarily, we're a little bit uncomfortable with them. India and China, for example, have an enormous border that is largely unsettled up in the high Himalayas. And if you look at it on YouTube, there are actually videos that are funny but also frightening of Indian and Chinese soldiers throwing punches at each other. Now, these kinds of incursions where Chinese go into what Indians claim is their territory and vice versa, they happen now a couple times a year. Both sides have strict orders not to shoot, but they are throwing punches at each other and then videotaping it for all the world to see. More worrying for India is that Chinese submarines and naval power has moved more and more into the Indian Ocean. And as the Indians put it to me, the Chinese submarines are sneaking around our coasts. So India is worried about China's massive economic expansion. They're worried about their trade imbalance with China. And they are also worried, as we are, that China is becoming much more assertive militarily in their neighborhood.
This might sound like a soft question, but I'm curious about whether there are conflicts in attitude just between their two cultures, the way that culturally Chinese people see the world and the way that culturally Indian people see the world.
Very much so, and it's a very good question. Historically, the two countries have both been great powers for thousands of years. You know, China's economy and India's economy were two of the dominant economies on Earth. And that only changed really in the 17th and 18th century with the rise of Europe and the strength of Europe's industrial revolution. Both China and India, of course, was colonized by the British. China had several centuries where they felt humiliated by Western powers and what they call the unequal treaties, where Britain, France, Russia, many others basically forced China to trade with them and treated the Chinese pretty unfairly. And as I said about India, both China and India only in the mid-late 1940s became the countries that they are today. So a lot of similar history there. They've reacted to that history very, very differently. India and its first prime minister, Nehru, decided that they were going to be unaligned. They weren't going to take part in the great power struggle between the Soviet Union and the U.S., and they were going to be the representative of the downtrodden around the world. China has a very different relationship to its past. It's not as comfortable with its past, and it is driving very hard to get back to the center stage, to be the middle kingdom as it always was, and to be get back to center stage on world affairs. And that sometimes makes them quite aggressive. I'll give you one example. When I was in Beijing recently, there's a beautiful exhibition at the National Museum, and it's called The Road to Revival. So it's for China, it's all about coming back into center stage where they think they should be.
China and India are both nuclear states. Is there reason to believe they would deploy the weapons they have only in a truly extreme case, which is to say a case that even a power like the United States would view to be extreme?
I do think both China and India are responsible nuclear powers. China, of course, is a nuclear state under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. And so there are inspections and things that go with that. India never joined the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, but they keep a very small nuclear arsenal. Many people think that is to defend against Pakistan, and in part it is. But it's also, and increasingly in large part, as a way to defend against their worry about China. India has never leaked its nuclear secrets, and I think we don't have any reason to believe that they would use their nuclear weapons in an irrational way. We worry much less about China and India's nuclear weapons programs than we do, for example, North Korea, which is terrifying, and Pakistan.
What might India do to counter the alignment of China with Russia?
India keeps fairly good relations with Russia, also similar to they sometimes cooperate and sometimes they have problematic relations. And the China-Russia relationship, I believe, is more dramatic in public. They want you to believe that the relationship is closer than it actually is. Russia is a declining power. Its economy is shrinking every year. And Putin is making a lot of noise to try to keep himself center stage. But China understands there's a reason that there was a big oil and gas deal announced a couple of years ago between China and Russia. And, you know, the price hasn't been set on that yet. And we believe it's because the Chinese are pushing the Russians so hard on the price that it's really not a very good deal for the Russians. So Russia is increasingly a junior partner in that partnership. They attend each other's military parades, but there's not really a whole lot of trust between them.
So that's something the United States wants to keep an eye on as well, because Russia doesn't typically respond well to feeling disrespected.
That's exactly right.
You make an interesting point that while diplomacy is very important, because so much of both countries' growth is linked to economic expansion, international businesses should also be paying close attention to India and China. How can business leaders contribute to a peaceful and prosperous world?
Our business leaders are already contributing to it, and we should continue to do so. We've already talked about how it's just much more comfortable diplomatically to do business with India than with China for cultural factors and the fact that we're both democracies. On the business side, our economic relations with China are very close. They are our fastest growing export market. Right now, it's very popular, especially with some of the presidential candidates, to make China the scapegoat for the difficulties that our manufacturing sector and some of our blue-collar workers are having. But our exports to China actually create a lot of good jobs right here in the United States. For example, if you just look at Boeing, one company, over a quarter of its planes are sold to China and India alone. If those markets were closed to us, there would be tens of thousands of layoffs just at Boeing, just one U.S. company. Chinese are increasingly investing in America. I think there should be some safeguards on that, but that is by and large a positive thing. So then those Chinese companies are creating jobs here at home. American companies, of course, investing in China, and often those companies have better, they're not perfect, but they have better labor and environmental standards. When I talk to some of the factory workers in China, they're happy to work for the suppliers of Western corporations because they have better salaries, better working conditions. It's by and large a better place to work. So there's a lot our companies can and should do.
We're speaking this hour with former State Department official Anya Manuel about her new book, The Brave New World, India, China, and the United States. We'll come back to the conversation in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
We have a lot of power with China. When China doesn't want to fix the problem in North Korea, we say, sorry, folks, you got to fix the problem. because we can't continue to allow China to rape our country. And that's what they're doing. It's the greatest theft in the history of the world.
And I'd like to send a very clear message to China. You may have your own economic problems, but don't try to undermine and take away jobs in our steel industry any more than you already have.
That was Donald Trump speaking at a rally in Indiana, followed by Hillary Clinton on MSNBC talking with Rachel Maddow. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. This hour, speaking with the co-founder and partner at the strategic consulting firm Rice Hadley Gates, former State Department official Anya Manuel. Her new book is called The Brave New World, India, China, and the United States. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or find us on Twitter at KERA Think. First of all, Anya, I'll make the point that we looked around for both candidates talking about India and could not find solid sound bites. And we'll address that in a minute. But first, I want to ask you about, you know, to the extent to which campaign rhetoric this season, 2016, relates to reality. When you hear the things that the candidates are talking about, are they the things that people within, say, the State Department are worrying about?
The rhetoric on China in particular has been very heated. You heard that quote from Donald Trump saying China is raping us, which I think is pretty unfortunate. It gets taken very seriously in China because, of course, they're not a democracy. They don't understand that election season can sometimes be silly season. And so they take some of these comments at face value. And I think if you take some of these arguments, it's China's fault, China is raping us, we need to uncouple from the Chinese economy. If you take those as face value and you go all the way down the line, it's a real problem for us. I don't want to be an apologist for China, and it is true that both China and India coddle their biggest companies. They make it hard for us to invest in many sectors, and we have to push back on them when they break some of the trade rules. But we can't just uncouple from this economy. We have $600 billion in trade between us. And as I said in the previous segment, this is supporting hundreds of thousands of jobs in the United States. It is true that some of the blue-collar jobs have moved overseas to cheaper jurisdictions, China, Vietnam, the Philippines, elsewhere. But punishing China doesn't bring those jobs back there, unfortunately. So I'm a little worried that some of this heated rhetoric is selling the American people a bill of goods, because even if you slap a 45% tariff on China, that isn't going to solve the problems that we have here in the United States.
Well, let's put a finer point on that. This idea that regardless, the jobs that have been lost to countries overseas are not coming back to the United States, full stop. There's not anything we can do to bring back the kinds of low-skilled manufacturing jobs that have been exported.
I think it would be very difficult to do so. You could force American companies to manufacture here. Our goods would be much more expensive. You could close our borders with everyone. The last time we tried slapping tariffs on many countries around the world was a long time ago, right after the Great Depression started in 1929 with the Smoot-Hawley tariffs. It made the Great Depression much, much worse. And it cost a lot of American jobs. It didn't bring them back. So this is not the solution. And as much as China might sometimes makes it difficult for us to cooperate with them, you have really two paths here. And I lay them out in the book. The book is mostly a storytelling book because I feel like the American public should understand what's going on inside both China and India and how they view the world and what challenges they're struggling with. But I make the point that you really have two paths. One path is you go down this path of aggression, you push back really hard, and then taken to its logical conclusion, you end up in probably a closer relationship, a closer partnership with India and the other Asian countries, and in a new Cold War with China, where our military expense goes up, where there is a trade war, where we can't solve big global problems like climate change and environmental issues. Or you say, we're not going to agree with China on everything. And maybe we'll disagree on a lot of things, but we owe it to ourselves and to our own people here in the U.S. to find a way to get along as well as we can.
You draw this interesting parallel to the way the British Empire conducted international business at the end of the 19th century.
I do. At the end, In the late 19th century, Britain was the great power on the world scene. And both Germany and the United States were the young upstarts that were challenging its power.
We were the India and China of our day.
We were the India and China. And Britain did two different things. Germany, they treated almost exclusively like an enemy. And they built up their navy. The Germans built up their navy. They ultimately ended up fighting two devastating world wars with Germany. But the United States, which also wasn't perfect, we had slavery. Britain was really opposed to slavery. We didn't believe in free trade. Britain was the biggest free trade nation. Britain treated the United States as someone where you would forgive a lot of missteps and mistakes. You would push back when the growing power, in this case the United States, overstepped the line. But we emphasized cooperation above all else. And so the alliance that's since been created between Britain and the U.S. wasn't inevitable. And I argue that all historical analogies are imperfect.
Right.
But by emphasizing cooperation wherever that is possible with both China and India, we create a world that's better for all of us.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Garvin on the line in Lake Highlands. Hi, Garvin.
Hello, Chris. Hello, Ms. Anya. I have a question about in my opinion, the U.S. in general doesn't seem to take India as seriously as China for a number of reasons. They don't have the same number of giant, record-setting projects, and they don't have the same standing on the world stage. For as big a country as India is, why is that? Why is that our perception, if indeed you think it might be accurate? And secondly, for as big a country as they are, why don't they have a bigger profile on the world stage? They're huge, and I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Thanks for your call.
Great. Thanks for your question. I agree with you completely. We should be taking India more seriously because of its demographic situation, because it's going to be 1.5 billion people in the next 15 years or so. And that has both a positive and a negative impact. Positively, it's going to be one of the great engines of world growth. Negatively, if they don't get their environmental issues under control, it's really a problem. And I'll give you an example. I travel a lot around both India and China. India actually has 13 of the 20 most polluted cities on Earth. So you think about the smog in Beijing, which is always in the news. It's very famous. It's actually much worse in India. When you go to the holy city of Varanasi along the river Ganges, there are corpses floating in the water, and right next to it, pilgrims are bathing. So these are big, big problems. They're both internal to India, but they can be exported if we don't all do something about them together. So I agree with you wholeheartedly that we should be paying more attention. And frankly, the public discourse doesn't talk very much about India. In government circles, there is a closer and closer relationship with India. Our Secretary of Defense, Ash Carter, was recently there. The military cooperation is getting closer and closer. We did a big civilian nuclear deal with them when I was in government in 2005 to 2007 to help bring India clean electricity. So there is a lot happening, but not as much in the public discourse as you would hope.
Anya, can we motivate sustainable environmental policy in India and China and still benefit from, let's face it, the cheap goods that we benefit from when we trade with those countries?
We certainly owe it to ourselves and to them to try. China is actually, I talked about the environmental devastation in India. China is much in the news, but it's ahead of India actually in solving this problem. So the problems are still staggering. When you go to one of China's coal mines, it's this huge hulking circle, 30 football fields in length. Those huge mining trucks look tiny in the distance. They look like toys. And so you see that they're going to keep doing everything they need to sustain growth. However, on the other side, there is a lot of public debate in China about the environment. And all officials from President Xi Jinping all the way down to the local mayors have been told that they must make their growth sustainable. They have very real targets. And as far as we can tell, they are really trying to meet them. China last year spent $110 billion on clean technologies. A lot of that money is going actually to American businesses that are working in China to helping them clean up their act. In the United States spent about half of that, $56 billion, and India is way behind at about $15 billion. So there are things that we can do. This is one of the great areas where we could actually cooperate to make a better world for all of us.
You say that we really missed an opportunity in neglecting to take any kind of important role in the formation of the Asian Infrastructure Bank. First of all, for people who are not familiar, what was its purpose? What is its purpose?
Yeah. Yes. So in decades ago, under U.S. stewardship, many international institutions were founded. The United Nations, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, the Asian Development Bank. And those institutions, especially World Bank and IMF, were designed to help build infrastructure in developing markets, to expand the roads and rails, and bring development to the world. They have not done a lot and not quickly enough to make room for big rising powers like China and India. So it took them years and years of foot dragging to finally change their voting rights in the IMF and World Bank so that developing economies that are now quite large, China is the second largest economy on earth, have voting rights that are commensurate with their economic heft. China got a little frustrated with this. And just this year, it was announced before, but it just was stood up fairly recently, created this thing called the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank, which is their own international institution. And I think this is actually something that we should be cautiously optimistic about. So in government, we always said to China, come be a responsible stakeholder. Help us govern the world. Come take more part in the UN and the World Bank and other places. China can do all of these huge investments where they're laying rails across Africa and they're building a huge port in Pakistan and the roads and the rail lines that are going to go all the way to China. They can do all this on their own. Their investments are massive and they are voluntarily, with the AIIB, restricting themselves and doing it through a multilateral institution that has 57 country members. We're just not one of them. So most of Europe joined, most of Asia joined, and they're going to have a moderating influence on how China acts in the international stage. And by staying out of it, we don't have that kind of say.
As both India and China grow in size and in economic and military might, what kind of behavior from them must we learn to tolerate, and what is worth really forbidding? To the extent that we have the power to do so.
Yeah, I'm glad that you said to the extent that we have the power to do so, because I think we always assume we have more influence than we actually do on some of these things. China is certainly being very aggressive militarily, both in the South China Sea with its island building. I'm sure you've seen the pictures of islands that didn't exist, and now all of a sudden they do, with airstrips and ports and things.
Excuse me for
also
asking.
In the East,
the idea behind that is that they can claim that they have territory, sea territory around those islands that they have constructed. Is that correct?
That's exactly right. There are a lot of disputes between Vietnam, the Philippines, China, to some extent Indonesia, about who owns what in that part of the ocean, in the South China Sea. The maps are imprecise, and China has claimed a huge swath of land, what they call the Nine-Dash Line, which is basically this tongue extending out thousands of miles from the Chinese coastline. It doesn't make any sense. But they see it this way. And you sometimes, you don't have to agree with their perspective, but you have to see it from their perspective occasionally. The ocean is China's lifeline. On their southern border, there's the Himalayas. You can't really get across them. In the west, there are deserts and plains. Very hard. Very little connectivity to the rest of the world. So they have to get all of those goods out and in through the ocean. 82% of China's oil comes through this tiny little strait between Malaysia and right by Singapore called the Malacca Strait. So they are legitimately worried that if the United States or others cut that off, it will be very difficult for China to import and export and get the stuff that it needs to its cities. They also have an island chain that's pretty much right off the coast, called the First Island Chain. And through that, the United States can get pretty close to Chinese coasts. And if you are a soldier in the Chinese Army or the Chinese Navy, it must seem pretty scary to see an American aircraft carrier group sailing right through your backyard, right past Hainan Island. So that's how they see the world. They feel like we're surrounding them and we're the aggressors. We, of course, see it differently. But when you look at it from that perspective, you could do a number of things. You could say, this island building won't stand, and we're going to be very clear and consistent about where the lines are. So it's been in the news just the past couple of months. We've been doing freedom of navigation operations, which means we sail by those islands to say, this is everybody's ocean, not just China's ocean. But we didn't do that for a few years. We stopped them. And now we've started them again. So if you're China, you think, are they really going to enforce this line? Yes or no? And at the same time that we are very clear and consistent about enforcing the lines, we need to find ways, even on the military side where it's hardest, to cooperate and talk. So let's talk about how to avoid accidents at sea and in the air that could quickly spiral out of control. Let's talk about cyber spying and how we can get over that. Some of those talks are in progress. They're slow and painful, but this is the painstaking work that's going to make sure that we don't end up in a conflict with China.
Anya Manuel is my guest. She's a former State Department official responsible for South Asia policy and a co-founder and partner at the strategic consulting firm Rice Hadley Gates. Her new book is called The Brave New World, India, China, and the United States. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can get to us on the new Think Tweet site. That is at KERA Think. I am also still tweeting at Chris Boyd Think. You can also email us, think@kera.org. We'll come back to the conversation in just a couple of minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Anya Manuel, co-founder and partner at the strategic consulting firm Rice Hadley Gates and former State Department official. Her new book is called The Brave New World, India, China, and the United States. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. Anya, what are the most effective strategies for the U.S. to communicate its disapproval of things that take place in China or India? And I imagine that they are different strategies because the cultures, the governments are so very different.
They're actually very similar strategies. We should communicate our disapproval clearly and quietly, out of the public eye. That is becoming harder and harder because, of course, the press is everywhere. It's a 24-hour news cycle. But, for example, some of my business partners have been diplomats for years and years, and they dealt with the Soviet threat. They said the types of near collisions and jostling for position that you see now between China and other countries in the South China Sea, you saw a lot between the United States and the Soviet Union. But the public didn't know about many of those crises because they were kept quiet, they were out of the public eye, and so it allowed the political class to respond calmly. Now, if there's, you know, there was just something in the news a couple days ago about the Chinese scrambling jets and hot dogging near our American aircraft. That is a lot easier to deal with. It's much harder for political systems to deal with a crisis if it's splashed all over the front page. If it's quietly, you can react calmly and you can diffuse the crisis. Otherwise, you have very little room for a maneuver. So we should definitely see where we have displeasure, but we should do it quietly.
Does corruption within the Chinese or the Indian governments mean that we cannot trust their leaders?
I think on a political level, we can trust what they say. Corruption is an enormous problem in both countries, and they both need to do more to overcome it. It's actually a perfect example on how the two societies differ. So China, you've heard a lot about its anti-corruption campaign. It has been all top down. Wang Shishan, the anti-corruption czar, if his organization starts interviewing someone and detaining someone, it's quite likely that they're going to be convicted. India is the opposite. It's a democracy, and it is its political power is very dispersed. Until a few years ago, no one in India was paying a whole lot of attention to the corruption, or there wasn't a public outcry about it. But finally, in 2011, an elderly gentleman named Anna Hazare, who looks a little bit like Gandhi, he's bespectacled and a very kindly face, he had finally had enough. And in true Indian style, he went on hunger strike and he struck a chord. Thousands and thousands of Indians came out into the street to support him. There were huge protests saying, "We have had enough. We can't go on the way that we're currently doing it." So the change in India has been all bottom up. It isn't perfect. The new perfect laws haven't been implemented, but there's some change. And the best one in India, I think the most promising change, is that the previous government, the Manmohan Singh government, started it, and this current Indian government under Modi is continuing a biometric ID program where 1 billion Indians, unbelievable that they were able to do this, but have put in their 10 fingerprints and 2 iris scans, and they now have a biometric identity where before they didn't. There wasn't social security numbers like there are here in the United States. And that cuts out a lot of the low-level graft. So where a low-level worker to get their pension would have to take a bus into a town and bribe the local bureaucrat to get paid, you know, and then lose a third of their pension by having to do that. Now you just scan in your irises and your fingerprints and you get the amount automatically in your bank account through this new biometric ID system. Both countries on corruption are imperfect. So I would say that there are only a few countries on earth that have successfully tackled it. A lot of them are in Asia. Hong Kong has done a great job. Singapore, South Korea, those were very corrupt countries several decades ago, and they are not now. What they did, in addition to the top-down, you know, arrest the big fish, like China is doing, and some of the bottom-up stuff that India is doing, they have established an independent commission, so politically independent. In China, it's not independent. And fast, in India, the courts are not fast, to try these cases. And they did a big education campaign for people all around in Hong Kong, in case the city, to say, this is no longer how we do business. And they put a lot of things online. So both India and China have done a little bit on corruption, but both have a long way to go.
Describe the trade relationship between India and China.
It is big, it could be bigger, and it is unbalanced, very similar to the U.S. and China. India imports a lot of its manufactured goods from China. So you go to an Indian market, and even those beautiful, I was just shopping there when I was there in the fall, those beautiful Indian pashmina shawls, I looked at them and they were actually made in China.
Wow.
So it's very similar to what we see here in the United States, that toys and inexpensive electronics and, you know, all of what you think of consumer goods, a lot of those are made in China. India exports to China a lot of raw materials, a lot of services because their IT companies are so good, and some higher level and higher value products. But there is a huge trade imbalance, so they're worried about it. India is worried about it, just like we are worried about our trade with China.
How would you characterize the similarities and differences in how they approach educating their children and young adults?
China is way ahead on this score, unfortunately for India. And it's one of the big challenges that India faces. Both China and India have big income inequality. And the biggest, best way to overcome that is by educating your young people. So I did a lot of interviews in the Delhi slums for the book. People are living in corrugated iron huts. They don't have plumbing. They don't have real access to education. There is education, but a lot of times the teachers aren't being paid enough, so they're not showing up to work. Some of the slum children have to work. So some of the children I dealt with, the family said, no, we don't want them to go to school. They need to help us at work. And work is climbing a trash heap that is 3 football fields tall, 300 yards, and taking out the recyclable materials. So they've sorted out the plastic bottles and stuff. So that's what a lot of these Indian children are doing. Not all. India's making a huge push, but it has to do a lot more. It has to train 1 to 2 million teachers.
Wow.
It has to help skill its people. So even the lucky few Indians that graduate high school or graduate college, often they're not educated enough to really be good for the job market. There was another great story. I was wandering around the center of Delhi, and a young Indian guy comes up to me just out of college, and he hands me his resume, and he says, "Madam, can you give me a job?" I sort of said, "You know, you don't know who I am. You don't know where I work. What are you talking about?" And he said, "You know, I just can't get a job here, so I'm trying absolutely everything I can." And this was a college-educated kid. So India has a big challenge. China, to its credit, the Communist Party really pushed education, and they spent a lot of money on education. And while it's imperfect, especially in the rural areas, many Chinese can get good education through high school and some even through college.
All right, let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Jim on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Jim.
Hey, hi. Yeah, it's a great conversation, but it brings up a point about the fact that India has so many people without electricity. The government, the national government, created and funded, helped fund solar electric industry. And the idea was that they could give, they didn't have to build coal or natural gas burning power plants. They could put domestic made solar products where it was needed. The companies and the individuals that were installing the solar were encouraged, incentivized by the government to use domestic content in their installations. Right off the bat, the U.S. filed trade sanctions with the World Trade Organization against India, forcing them, and eventually winning, not surprisingly, and forced them to buy on the open market.
Well, what do you know about that, Anya?
Yeah, these are the vagaries of the world of international trade and the WTO. You're absolutely right to mention this. India is trying to make a big push into solar power, not as much as China, but they are absolutely trying. And they had domestic content restrictions. They said, we want our solar panels to be built in India. And you know why? Because they were worried about cheap imports from China. They weren't worried about the United States. In fact, they wanted to do business with our solar companies, but you can't discriminate in that way. So there was a WTO case, and India lost. There is still a lot going on in clean energy, not as much as I said before. You know, China last year spent $110 billion on green energy, the U.S. $56 billion, India only, I think, about $11 billion. So there is a lot left to do. The good thing is that Prime Minister Modi and his team are very much attuned to this issue. Both, I think the biggest push they have to make is to get India the infrastructure that it needs to grow. So where in China, every airport is gleaming and every road has been built, and frankly, it looks a lot nicer than some of our airports and roads here in the U.S., India is so far behind. They need, according to some estimates, $1 trillion worth of investments. And that is everything from more electricity, better roads, upgrading the railway system, everything that you need for a modern economy to function. They're a little bit behind, and they need to push it. This has, of course, an environmental impact because they're trying to move to clean energy, but India also has a lot of coal deposits. They haven't mined them very effectively. And when I talk to folks, including the energy minister in India, he said, I get it. We don't want all of these dirty coal plants, but what choice do we have? For a while, we're going to have to rely on this, and we're going to have to grow. And you, America, can't tell us what to do. So it's difficult.
What you've just said suggests an answer to my next question, but I will ask it anyway. How does the urbanization of India compare with the extraordinary, dramatic changes of China from a mostly rural nation to one that is really overwhelmingly urban today?
Mm-hmm. China is far more urban than India. Neither country has handled it perfectly, but it's just staggering the difference. So when you see Chinese migrant workers, hundreds of millions of them, that poured into China's cities, most of them worked in factory towns. And like in India, where I just described the slums that are around Delhi and they're around Mumbai, you know, they're everywhere, where it was disorganized migration. In China, it's far from perfect. It's not always organized. But by and large, these poor people coming from the countryside live in factory dorms. So unlike the corrugated iron huts with no plumbing, in India, they live in dorms. Maybe it's 8 people to a room, 16 people to a room. It's not that comfortable. People sleep in shifts because some are doing the night shift at the factory and some are doing the day shift. But they have a rec room with a ping pong table. They have electricity and plumbing. They have some little food stalls and restaurants that have opened up in the caste. So the character of the migrants and of the poverty that they experience is very different in China and in India.
We just have about a minute left. What does each country really want from the United States?
India wants a close partnership, but not an alliance. That's very different because they were standoffish from us for a long time. That's really turned around just in the last decade. And I think that's a positive development. China, I don't think, wants to be our enemy. They have a lot of conflicts with us, but they are mostly fixated, just like we are here. They are worried about their domestic economic problems. They're worried about their own growth, their income inequality, their environmental degradation. They want to have a good life for their people and their children, just like we do here. So I think conflict with China is not inevitable, and there are some pretty basic things that we can all do to make sure that it doesn't happen that way.
Anya Manuel is co-founder and partner at the strategic consulting firm Rice Hadley Gates, and she's a former State Department official responsible for South Asia policy. Her new book is called The Brave New World, India, China, and the United States. Anya, it's been a really interesting conversation. Thank you very much for making this time for us.
Thank you, Chris. It was a pleasure.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy, with help on the phones today from Elizabeth Myung. Samantha Guzman is associate producer and Jeff Whittington is executive producer. We have a new Twitter handle for the show that is at KERA Think. I'm still tweeting as well at Chris Boyd Think, but when you want to talk to the show, send that to at KERA Think. You can contact us via email, as always, to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.